Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the studios at KCBX in San Luis Obispo. Come along and join me for a fascinating conversation with Katja Sengel, adjunct professor of journalism at Cal Poly State University. Hi, Katja.
Hi, Tom.
So you've been up to a lot of good, huh?
Yeah, kind of an exciting spring for me. I have two of my books are coming out in paperback, and they're updated and with all new chapters on some. And I have some San Luis Obispo events to go with those.
And book number one is?
So From Chernobyl with Love, Reporting from the Ruins of the Soviet Union, is about my time reporting in Ukraine and also Latvia earlier this century, and it kind of...
So you were there just post the fall of the Russian Empire.
Yeah, so it was about I was in Latvia less than 10 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, so late 90s and then Ukraine, early 2000s, and it kind of sets the stage well for what is going on now as far as some of the background and the context that I think is needed to help understand. I did a piece for Smithsonian. Actually, they're online. I do their magazine too, but they're online, about the history of Ukraine when everyone was talking about the whole Nazi connection and things. I think we talked about that on a show, actually, possibly.
Let's refresh that. That's an important nuance.
Yeah, and it was actually, I think it got voted one of the top 10 stories for Smithsonian online last year, 2022.
Wow.
And it was kind of going into, there was being thrown around a lot that Russia's, one of its reasons for invading Ukraine was that all Ukrainians were Nazis and those kind of things. And so it really, I talked to a bunch of historians.
Where did that come from?
Well, so what happened was when Ukraine was trying to establish independence earlier in the 20th century, there were some Ukrainian freedom fighters who did end up serving under the Germans as a way to get out from under the Soviets. And so there was some of that in there. But the idea that the whole country is Nazis, or that the independence movement came out of that.
A parallel would be Finland. And out of survival in World War II, they chose the lesser of two evils, and they invited the Nazis to come into Finland and occupied up in the north.
Exactly. I think here in the U.S. it's sometimes hard for us to understand. We're such a huge country, but a lot of Latvia, very similar. It was like, okay, you choose between the Germans or the Russians, and who's the greater threat right now? In Asia, it's kind of choose between China and, you know, so you've got to look. So it was a lot going into that, and that was... So the book, though, will take, so I guess by way of saying, history is so important in understanding what's going on in Ukraine now and some of the post-Soviet history in particular and such. But then the book also, it talks about my time there, and this updated version includes a chapter that I didn't have in that original book, which I had really wanted in, but we had to cut it for space reasons. So I was able to get that back in, and it kind of tells the story about my adapting, coming back to the U.S. after Ukraine, and ending up in the South, which I'm not from. So it's kind of it's a serious topic. It's definitely, that book has a lot of humor in it. There's also often a lot of humor coming out of tragedy and difficulties, and post-Soviet humor is great. So there's that. And then I also update on the people I write about in the book, what has happened to them since the war started. So it's a nice way to tell people some of those things.
So you were based and living in Kyiv in the early 90s, right?
Early 2000s.
Oh, early 2000s. But again, that was not too long after the fall of Russia. Did you have any foreshadowing sense of Russia wanting to take over Ukraine?
Well, it's funny. I was talking to, on another assignment the other day, a Ukrainian who she left, I think, a year or so after I did, and she was talking about how she always knew this was going to happen. She said,
really?
But her parents didn't because they were the older generation.
Mm-hmm.
And
why did she think was it inevitable?
She just said it was clear that Russia was always, you know, thought of Ukraine just as part of its empire, and
mm-hmm.
and it was clear to her, but her parents who grew up under Soviet times didn't see it the same way. But I can't say I always saw it. I did always see there was definitely, when I was there, Kuchma was president, and he was a Moscow-supported and Russian-leaning president. It seemed like there were usually, after independence, it went back and forth between veering towards the left, towards Russia, or veering towards the West, and there's always been a push and pull. Ukraine, I mean, one of the reasons I'd wanted to report from there is I knew it would always be relevant to the news, because there was, when I was there, it was the talk of NATO, do you join NATO or not join NATO, and there was always that U.S. and Russia push and pull, but it was more mild than now. I feel like now we've gotten back more to almost Cold War times in some ways, whereas when I was there, it was still kind of thawed out a bit. And so I can't say I saw it, but I did always see there's definitely always a threat from Russia and thrust in the push and pull from the West.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, he was CIA and Rand Scholar and an analyst for that whole area of the world, born and raised in Bulgaria towards the end of the Stalinist regime. And he said that one of the allures for Russia to invade and take over Ukraine was the fact that it's a major breadbasket. It's a huge producer of grain for the world. Is that one of the drivers of Russia taking it over or wanting to?
Huge breadbasket, so true, and we're seeing the effects of that in all sorts of countries now since the war happened. I don't know, I'm not as good at knowing exact reasons and such, but I do think that's probably one of them. I think the Crimea and the Black Sea fleet and all of that there is another huge military one, not to mention a great vacation place along the Black Sea.
But it's for the Navy, the Russian Navy.
Yes.
It's a Sevastopol and whatnot. It's a major allure to have that
exactly, yeah.
naval base.
And then I think just the idea is some in the Putin and his allies kind of see Russia is this the idea of empire, and Ukraine, yes, would be a great thing to add to that. And they see them as their little brothers or little sisters. I remember even when I was in Ukraine and I had to go to Moscow, and they'd kind of make fun of the Ukrainian accent or just see it as not all Russians see it that way, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that's kind of what's being used now is kind of it is part of that expanding Russian empire.
So going a little far afield, maybe, but maybe not, Transnistria and Moldova. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so that was, and it's interesting, too. It was another with Russian influence and such. That was a breakaway republic of Moldova that declared itself its own country, recognized by Russia and them and no one else, had their own money, own president, everything. But one of the reasons they were able to do that is there was a lot of supposedly weapons left behind from the Russian military, and there was a large Russian military presence. And so you actually have in the former Soviet Union, a lot of these little breakaway places where the Soviet Union would do these things, gift certain territories, like Crimea was officially gifted to Ukraine, but they would also move people around. So there would be in different countries little slivers of a different nationality within that country. And so it helped with loyalty and making everyone feel part of the Soviet Union. But when the Soviet Union fell apart, it left people of different nationalities in these little pockets in different countries that then would declare their own independence and things. And if they had still Russian troops there and weapons, it was kind of a mess, but very fascinating.
One of the most enigmatic places where you've been, Transnistria.
Yeah. So I was there when I was living in Ukraine. I'd always wanted to go there because I heard about it, and I heard about the weapons cache and how it worked. And there was a lot of rumors about, because it's on the border with Ukraine and Moldova, that a lot of smuggling and those types of things. And so to get there, I had to actually meet an official from Transnistria. And then I remember passing through with the buses. We took an overnight bus and stuff. It was kind of complicated because I'm like, which authorities are these? Are these Ukrainian? Are these Moldovan? Are these Transnistria? Mm-hmm. And Transnistria would give you this little paper, and you had to go the first thing. It was very Soviet style. Still had the hammer and sickle everywhere and things.
Wow.
And you had to register with the police first thing when you got to Transnistria. But they're not really recognized by anyone else. And so then when you're leaving, you haven't, I can't remember if you haven't actually passed through Moldovan authorities yet, but you're officially kind of in Moldova, but it was super confusing. I remember I changed my money, because in Transnistria you can only use the money they recognize there, and I tried after I left to change the money at an official money changer, and they just laughed at me. They're like, we don't recognize this money. So
wow.
It's like it exists in this very small sliver of land.
So you still have that money in your dresser
somewhere?
I'm
trying to remember what happened to that money. I wish I did. I don't think I do. I have a book, though, that was written by the president. So I got an interview with the president, and then he put it on TV because it was a big deal, American Reporter.
Right.
Meeting
yeah.
with the president, and so he wrote this very self-glorified book about himself, which I have, which mm-hmm. talks about the whole thing. So,
is it printed in Russian or?
Yes. And they had, I remember, and then there was definitely, we definitely had a tail the whole time, the translator, and I remember we're like, oh, there he is, hi guy, oh, there he is again.
That's so cool. So back to hometown, San Luis Obispo, and the launch of your paper packs.
Yeah, so on April 13th in the evening, I think it's a 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Cal Poly in the Student Union, we're going to have an event for the paperback launch of From Chernobyl with Love, and I will be speaking along. The journalism department is putting it on, and it's actually going to be not just my book. It's going to be another Cal Poly grad's book. Julia Bricklin wrote a book about Polly Pry, which was an early female journalist who kind of was the someone had described From Chernobyl with Love a little bit gonzo, and Polly Pry was a lot gonzo. She did a lot of crazy stuff early.
What was her thematic approach? What was
kind of human interest again, a little bit of everything. And she just would really, it was more that era because it was earlier in the 20th century when you could kind of do that really go gonzo on things. So Julia will be talking about her, and then we have.
And the name of her book is?
Polly Pry. And there may be a subtitle on it, but definitely Polly Pry and Julia Bricklin. And then we're going to have a professor, Emily, who is in women's studies and some other departments as well, who's going to be talking to us about women in news and kind of focusing on those two books.
And once again, where are the events going to take place?
This is going to be April 13th on Cal Poly campus at the University Union. The exact room I'll have to update you on, but you can find it on my website, and we'll also be putting some things out around Cal Poly through
and
the journalism.
And your website. Yes.
It's just my name, Katya cengel.com. And if you look under events, it'll have the exact room number there. But on campus at the Student Union.
Mm-hmm. And one little cute aside, your first name, Katya, that served you well when you were stationed in
Kiev. Yeah, it's so funny. It's like, I think people see that now and they're like, oh, is that a Ukrainian or a Russian writing this book? Or I was born in Berkeley. That's how I give the explanation for my name. But my
dad. So your parents liked the name.
Yeah, my dad is of Slovak descent, and mm-hmm. His family didn't want me to have a Slovak name because they wanted me to have an American name. Uh-huh. But my mom, with the last name Sengel, thought I needed a more ethnic name, and so she just looked up Russian names, and so she came up with Katya, which is actually the diminutive of Ekaterina, but she just named me the shorter name because she wanted the short name, mm-hmm. so I wouldn't have nicknames. And then I go over, and in Ukraine, everyone's name, every other person is named Katya practically. And so I remember
you blended right in.
Yeah. So I was used to in the U.S., you know, never hearing my name. And then over there, people calling it all the time. And so I'd always turn my head and it wouldn't be me. And then my favorite quote was always someone who said, "Your English is so good." I was like, yeah, wait till
it's
you hear my
better,
Russian.
Yeah. So you do speak a little Russian, yeah?
I did. When I lived over there, I learned Russian at the time. And now this has become a more political thing. But at the time, in Kiev, in most of Ukraine except the West, the language used was primarily Russian. Mm-hmm. Street signs, everything was Russian.
And that's changed because of nationalism a lot.
I'm pretty sure it's all gone to Ukrainian now in most of those areas, which makes sense. It was just at the time, it still made sense mm-hmm. to have Russian. And so it was much more useful to me at the time to have Russian versus Ukrainian, unless I was going to the west of the country. And most mm-hmm. of my reporting, I went around the country a lot, and I did go to the west sometimes, but a lot was east, central, and Kiev area.
You've spent time in Helsinki, right?
No, I never got to Helsinki.
I spent a lot of time there and walking the neighborhoods and whatnot. And it's fascinating because some of the older buildings, the signage is still in Russian when the Tsarist.
Wow.
Yeah. So fascinating legacy that.
Well, that's the other thing I liked about learning Russian is it could get you by and most post-Soviet places. I mean, these days, not as much because it's more the older generations. But at the time, with the older generations, if you had Russian, you could kind of, it gets you further than Latvian or Ukrainian in a lot of ways.
Okay. One more time. Go to
April 13th at Cal Poly campus, the Student Union, 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. We're going to be having the book launch. That'll actually be the only local book event I'm doing for From Chernobyl with Love. So we'd love to see people there.
And a website again, go-to would be you?
Yeah, just Katya, K-A-T-Y-A, Sengel, CENGEL.com. And if you look under events, you'll see my local events.
Katya Sengel, adjunct professor, journalism, Cal Poly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the KCBX studios.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.